On this week's Monocle Reads, I'm speaking to Paul Morland, who's the author of The Human Tide. It's a dazzling new history. It discusses the underestimated influence of population as a crucial factor in global shifts and the events of the last two centuries. Well, Paul's here to talk us through how rising populations have been the catalyst for pivotal events throughout the past 200 years. As the population continues to rise, well, what does this mean for our beloved planet Earth? Paul, welcome.
Hello.
Now, you're an associate research fellow at Birkbeck College at the University of London and a renowned authority on demography. It's a much overlooked subject, it would seem to me, certainly within popular culture.
I was surprised when I started to think about this book that nothing had been done along those lines. So lots of history totally ignores demography. And there are serious historians who write big sweeping histories, like Richard Evans, for example. I'm a great fan of his. Or Eric Hobsbawm, not an ideological fan, but like his style and his approach. And they will take account of demography. But nobody had written a book on the last 200 years from a demographic angle. At best, demography gets a small part in the cast, a walk-on role, but nobody's really put it centre stage until now.
I mean, you define it as essentially about three things.
Well, it's very simple, demography. It's births, deaths and movement. So if you look at the population of a country or a region or even a continent, its size is only determined by how many people are added to the stock, how many people leave the stock through death and how many come in and out. And these three simple facts can tell us an awful lot about change.
When we look at how the planet and how our species, rather, has developed over the past 200 years, I mean, you point out that in the 1700s, for instance, although the population was much, much smaller, living conditions were much, much worse. How does that work?
Well, if we go back to the past, we had a period, most of human history, when, as I put it elsewhere, we bred like rabbits and died like flies. There was very little science, there was little technology. And, of course, in the 17th century, the scientific revolution was getting underway. But for most people, conditions were extremely primitive. And so the chance of surviving your first year and then up to puberty and to the point of marriage was probably roughly 50-50. So people had large families and many, many died in babyhood and many died before having the chance to procreate, which is why, for most countries, most periods of time, population growth was slow and there were few people on the planet.
The one thing that you point out made a fundamental difference was education, and particularly education of women.
Yes, I have a couple of friends who live locally. One was educated at Oxford and one at Cambridge, and they have respectively 7 and 6 children. So they are, I always think of, the great exceptions to the rule. And the rule is that when you give women education, whether it's literacy to start with or tertiary university education in the end, they want to self-actualise, they want to have careers, they want to think for themselves. And whilst they may well be maternal in their instincts and want to have children, they're very, very unlikely to wish to have anything like the 6 or 7 children that my exceptional friends have had.
Now, you talk in the book about the decisive role played by demography in the rise of the superpowers. So here we're talking Russia, we're talking America, possibly China. But you also talk about the fact that Russia is heading for disaster and the future is Africa.
Well, Russia has had a rise in its fertility rate of late. I should say, when demographers speak of fertility, they mean the number of children women have. So they're not talking biologically. All the reasons come together, and then how many children does a woman have? Russia's had a very, very long period of low fertility. It alarmed Brezhnev originally. It's alarming Putin. Putin's done things about it, and whether they've had an effect or not, so whether they're the causal root of the rise of Russian fertility, Russian women are now having more children. But they've had such low fertility for so long that they are now facing a population decline. And it's very hard to see how a country which once had Russia's status can keep that status when its population is going down year on year. But Africa is the last place in the world where we have high fertility, huge population growth in the works, regardless of what happens, actually. And so Africa's got enormous potential for economic and social and political transition. Whether it will take that potential, we don't know. But my guess would be certain countries in Africa will certainly make a success of the demographic transition that they're currently enjoying.
And you talk about the rise of the superpowers and you put that down to birth. Why?
Well, if you look back at the era of the great powers before the First World War, there were There was Britain, there was France, there was Germany, and so on. Why did we get to the point from the middle of the century, the middle of the 20th century, that Russia and the United States just took off? And I think the answer is that whereas back in the middle of the 19th century, their populations were not so large, they had potential to grow enormously, and they took that potential. And in fact, this is something that Alexis de Tocqueville, the great 19th century French commentator, noticed. Back in the early 19th century, he said these two countries have enormous potential to grow. Russia had a huge fertility rate and falling mortality rate in the early 20th century, despite all its disasters. America combined that with being an enormous magnet for immigration. And so both populations grew well beyond that of France, Germany or Britain. And so they were able to have much bigger economies, much bigger armies. And essentially that's why they overshadowed the traditional powers of Middle Europe.
Mm-hmm. And just looking at America and Britain, can population change explain the rise of Trump and of Brexit?
I think what we can see if we look at the data is that the biggest factors which have caused discontent in the United States and in Britain, and which have given rise to the reaction of electing someone so off-field, as it were, as Trump, and giving the political elite such a surprise as Brexit, the greatest concerns are not so much economic, but they're social. And a very big part of that has been the very rapid change in the demography of these countries. So Britain, back as recently as the mid-1990s, was something like 93-94% people of British or Irish heritage. This has been falling very rapidly. Our central cities have been transformed. America is heading for white minority sometime in the middle of the 21st century. Whether we think that's a wonderful thing or a terrible thing, it's certainly a dramatic change in the ethnic balance of both our countries. And therefore, it's not altogether surprising that there has been a reaction. And whilst you can certainly see an economic and other factor at play in Brexit and Trump, I think what concern about the very rapid shift in the ethnic composition of those countries and a backlash is a big part of the explanation.
Now, we're speaking now as coronavirus is basically becoming this huge pandemic going all over the world. In your book, you talk about how China is going to get old long before it gets rich. I wonder if this virus will fundamentally change the trajectory.
Well, my guess is that it won't, because the population of the world is growing at a much slower rate than it was. So back in the 70s, it was growing perhaps 2% a year. Now it's growing about 1% a year. We could have a massive disaster with tens of millions of people dying, which would totally sear our view of the world and change an awful lot of things. But actually, 1% population growth a year means that in total population terms, the world would very soon recover. So it's interesting, between 1910 and 1920, we had the First World War and the terrible Spanish influenza. And yet the population of the world, which was growing fairly fast at that point, continued to grow. The population was larger in 1920 than 1910. So in pure demographic terms, I think this will probably have a fairly limited effect. 1 year of population growth setback is pretty minor, and yet it would mean tens of millions of people dying. So as I say, something could happen that's very dramatic and has a huge impact on our imagination and the way we see the world, but not actually all that big in purely demographic terms.
Right. Now, I know that in some parts of the world, fertility rates are plunging when one really wouldn't expect it. Why is that?
Well, it used to be the case that as women got more educated, as people got wealthier, they got more urbanised, their fertility rate would fall for the reasons we've discussed. Women have control over their bodies. They generally don't want such large families. People living in towns will often want to invest in their children rather than see their children as an asset. So in the countryside, classically, more children, more hands in the fields. In the city, you have one or two, you invest in their education, they have great opportunities. So all that happens. What's actually happened is that the demography's kind of got ahead of the economy. So there are countries which have only really started to develop and not that far down the path. A country like Thailand, where many people are poor, and yet women are actually deciding to have smaller families. It's become a cultural thing. I was very struck by the data for Calcutta, for example, a city I haven't been to since the mid-80s, where women have barely more than one child each these days. So it used to be that demography and economic development kind of went hand in hand. And as you developed, your fertility rate came down. What's happened now, I think for cultural reasons, is that the demography is running ahead of the economics.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to look at Japan now, because as you point out, Japanese people are living much, much longer. How can the rest of us learn from that?
Well, I think that their diet obviously has an effect. Their cohesiveness as a society probably has an effect. I think what's interesting about Japan, of course, is not only that they have a very, very long life expectancy, well, that, you know, several years longer than ours, but not dramatically, but they have achieved that. They also have a very, very low fertility rate, very small numbers of babies born, a declining population, and they're very resistant to immigration. So all of that means that Japan, like Russia, has now entered the realm of declining population. And I think the great lesson from Japan, surely there are lessons we can learn about how to live longer and more healthily, but the really interesting lesson we're going to get from Japan over the next decades is how you cope with a declining population and a very old population. Mm. I think a lot is going to have to do with technology. How do we find the technological ways around this problem as we have more and more old people who need care and fewer young people able to see to their needs?
Yeah, technology, as you say, absolutely the future.
It's going really to have to be.
Yeah, yeah. What was the reason for the first population explosion here in Britain?
This was really only understood. It started to happen at the beginning of the 19th century, perhaps the end of the 18th century, and it was only really understood as demographic transition theory was developed in the early 20th century. And what happened, again, to come back to the terms I've used earlier, is for a period we continued breeding like rabbits, but we stopped dying like flies. So people were used to having very large families. Contraception was not very available at that point. And all the way into the middle of the 19th century, the average woman had six or so children. But what happened that was dramatic was, whilst that had always been the case, basic changes in diet, improvements in education, a degree of urbanisation which allowed people to have access to medical facilities, those changes, those classic 19th century changes, made a big difference to the death rate. More children survived. In fact, the infant mortality rate in Britain really only fell towards the end of the 19th century, but those who did survive childhood lived longer. And as a result, instead of the population knocking along at a low level with lots of new arrivals and lots of departures in terms of births and deaths, the British population, because of the fall in the death rate, more or less quadrupled in the course of the 19th century. That despite the fact that there was massive emigration, very little immigration, massive emigration. The Brits managed to, by which I include the Irish, Scots, Welsh and English, managed to populate huge continents, Canada, Australia and so on, and at the same time to quadruple their population. That was all to do really in the 19th century with a falling death rate.
And I see you've got a wonderful statistic, seven times as many people claiming Irish descent in the USA than there are in Ireland, North and South combined.
Well, if you think of Ireland, it continued, it persisted to have a high birth rate. So eventually, in most countries, as people get used to the fact that many children are not going to die, and as they get more educated and more urbanised, their family sizes fall. Ireland carried on pumping out very large numbers of children well into the 20th century, but at home only more recently managed to develop and offer economic opportunities. So in a way, Ireland became the womb of the Western world, and many, many of those people came to the UK, it was all the UK at one point, but came to the British mainland. Very large numbers of people in Britain have Irish ancestry, and likewise Australia, Canada, and of course the United States.
Mm. Now, Boris Johnson has promised us a Brexit bump. He says we should all now go forth and see a wonderful rise in the British birth rate. How far does population rise feed into politics?
Well, I'm not sure. It obviously has a two-way effect. So we've talked about something like Brexit. It's very interesting in Britain now that really it's age and not class that determines how you vote. It's a young, old split between Labour and Tories rather than a upper class / middle class and lower class / working class split. So I think we can understand a lot about politics from a demographic angle. The other question, of course, is what politicians can do in terms of changing the demography. So demography affects politics. How does politics affect demography? Well, first of all, of course, governments can have a big effect on immigration rates, and we'll see what happens with immigration. I think it's going to be a hot topic, and we'll see what this so-called Australian point system means and whether it reduces the huge immigration that we've experienced in the last 20, 30 years or not. I think governments can have a limited effect on the death rate, of course, by what they spend on the health service, but they're actually, in demographic terms, fairly limited. The interesting question is what a government can do about fertility. So in a developing country where the government wants to bring fertility down, it can certainly offer services of contraception and education and educate its women. That can be very effective. What's really interesting is what can a government do in a developed country with a low fertility rate to get that fertility rate up. Now, Boris Johnson, of course, has set a great example by having a large number of children himself, unlike some of our recent prime ministers. The question really is whether he's prepared to put his money where his mouth is and put incentives in for people to have more children, if that's what the government wants, and then in turn, how effective that is. And generally, in developed countries, pronatal economic incentives have a pretty patchy record. They seem to have some effect, but a fairly limited one in people's choices on the size of their families.
Mm. Finally, Paul, I want to look at the environment and how much the growth of our global population really impacts on the planet.
Well, I think there are real reasons to be optimistic. And the most important one is that we were growing population-wise at 2% a year globally, and we're now growing at 1% a year. And by the end of the century, it's very likely that human population will have stabilised. Of course, it's putting huge strains on the planet, but nevertheless, the pressure is beginning to decline. And we see in places like Bulgaria, there's serious population decline, and there's rural depopulation, and large areas are returning to nature. The other thing, of course, is urbanisation, where people move to the cities, abandon the countryside, and again, that makes more room for nature. But I think the other reason to be optimistic is not only is the number of people beginning to slow down in terms of its increase, but also more and more people are educated, more and more people are plugged into the internet, more and more people are thinking, getting an education and able to make a contribution. And I think scientific technological progress is going to be the way we get ourselves out of this problem, revolutionising the way we produce energy, revolutionising the way we produce food. And whatever we've achieved so far as a human race, we've achieved it with a fairly small number of people participating in that great technological advance. Today, more and more people across the world are getting the kind of education that they will be able to participate. And therefore, I think we can expect technological change to speed up, and our pressure on the planet can actually reduce per head through technological advance.
And as you say, the book, demography and destiny will continue to be entwined, and it will shape the course of history.
It will, and that is the subject of the next book.
Aha! There's another one, a follow-up.
There's another one in the pipeline, yes.
So there should be, because and we haven't had time to go into all of this, but I mean, it really is a panoramic view of the last couple of hundred years, showing us just how much the sheer weight of numbers has mattered. So I'm very glad that we'll get a follow-up on that. The Human Tide, How Population Shaped the Modern World, is published by John Murray, and it is by Paul Morland. Paul, thank you very much
thank
for coming
you.
In. You've been listening to Monocle Reads, thanks to the production team of Steph Chungu, Nora Hull and Charlie German. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.